The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi, Kennedy. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Friday, June 11th. Good Friday to you. I hope you have a great weekend. A lot of news. The United States is emerging from the virus quite effectively, and life is returning to normal. But across the globe, as the Wall Street Journal reminds us, the COVID deaths this year in 2021 have already eclipsed all of 2020's toll. So the virus continues to rage. It came from China. We assume it came out of a lab. That is the most persuasive explanation, not conclusively proven, not engineered to ravage, but accidentally released. And the new virus outbreak in China, we shouldn't believe anything they tell us about it. Nothing. The big story yesterday in the United States, U.S. consumer prices climbed at the fastest pace since 2008 in May. That is remarkable, and it's bad news for everyone. Which higher prices are here to stay? Asked the Wall Street Journal in their front page story. We don't really know. Some will abate. We expect, for example, the 30% year-over-year rise in used car prices to abate, to drop, but not in commodities, not in housing, not in food, and not in gasoline. The New York Times says prices jumped 5% in May, faster than expected. That's simply not true, but it's par for the course for the New York Times. You can't spend this much money, made-up money, printed money, as the Democrats have spent since January of this year on top of the genuine COVID relief of last year, and not get this kind of inflation. And it robs everyone. It particularly robs seniors. It particularly robs people of small income, who have to start making choices between drugs and food, who have to make choices between buses and car rides, who have to make choices between clothes for child A and clothes for child B. Inflation is the thief of everybody. The Wall Street Journal, a Made in Washington inflation spike editorial, I put it on Twitter. You should go and read the entire thing. It simply says, look, this was simply incredibly, irresponsibly created by the federal government. You cannot print this much money. Go and read the background on it. Wall Street Journal, I put it out on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. I ask you to follow me there. I also ask you to go and listen to yesterday's Chris Christie interview on my podcast, The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. I do two podcasts today. This one, The Rundown, the concentrated Hugh Hewitt show, and then The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. And they've been great ones this week. But Chris Christie yesterday, lots of you downloaded it, wanted to hear his critique of China, his critique of former President Trump's relationship with Xi, and his assessment of what's ahead in the next 3 years. In the Financial Times this morning, a long, slow, painful death. Biden's domestic agenda withers as he jets abroad. Joe Biden, the president, is in Great Britain, but his domestic agenda is going down the tubes in the Senate. He hadn't got 51 votes. He hasn't got 51 votes to break the filibuster to allow him to do anything with his 51 votes. Time is running out, according to the Washington Post. Democrats split over Biden's relentless focus on infrastructure. They'd rather the focus on something else he can't get passed. But the deal is, with a 50-50 Senate, you need 60 votes. It's not going to happen. There are, however, green shoots in some bipartisan work. The Get Tough on China Act is what I call it. Todd Young, senator from Indiana, will be along later today to discuss it. 10 Senate Democrats and Republicans say they reached a five-year trillion-dollar infrastructure deal that involves no new taxes. I don't think they will be able to sell this to the conference for the simple reason there's another reconciliation out there. And if they spend trillion now, the Democrats will jam down another trillion and the taxes in the reconciliation bill. They can't trust them. They can't believe it. And therefore, they ought not to be giving them anything until after we see the next reconciliation bill. Ilhan Omar has split the Democratic Party deeply after a racist assault and an anti-Semitic assault on Israel, and comparing Israel and the United States to Hamas and the Taliban. She sort of kind of apologized yesterday after being condemned by all but AOC and Rashida Tlaib. Nevertheless, she remains, and she should be censured, actually, for comparing the United States to the Taliban and Israel to Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization. The Taliban suppresses women and destroys the human rights of everyone they rule. But she's a member of Congress from the United States, having immigrated here legally. I'm glad for her success. I wish she had some gratitude in her heart towards this country. New York Post, parents rage as top New York City school plans to end advanced math program. A top Manhattan middle school sent parents into a rage when it announced that it was junking accelerated math classes and agreed to hold meetings amid the backlash. And what some families ripped is the Department of Education's latest smothering advanced academic lab middle school for collaborative studies. Principal Megan Adams emailed parents that we will no longer have leveled math courses at lab middle school. I know this is a change, she wrote without offering any rationale. I assure you that this decision was not made lightly. Look, this is the trend. Get equality among students by making the smart ones really cripple their education. It's happening in Virginia. Glenn Youngkin's going to be the next Virginia governor, I believe, because of what's gone on in the state of Virginia and how parents are rebelling against Democrats at the Education Department, Democrats in the legislature, Terry McAuliffe's legacy of mediocrity in the state. But everywhere across the United States, parents are saying, what has happened to our schools? They're waking up to it. The COVID pandemic simply made it very obvious to that, which all of us have known for a long time who study schools. Teachers' unions and bureaucracies are against excellence. They just are. Japan is reporting a joyless Olympics, according to the Washington Post. A hyper-cautious bureaucracy. How about that? And a slow vaccine rollout makes the Olympics not a time for joy, but a time for worry. The ruthless hackers behind ransomware attacks on U.S. hospitals. This is a story that we've seen here and there, but a hospital chain in Las Vegas, another attack in Oregon, one in New York. One by one, hospitals are falling prey to ransomware, and they're ruthless. They will turn off the monitors. They'll stop the surgeries. They'll interfere with the drug deliveries until hospitals pay up. If there was an infrastructure bill that cyber-hardened the United States and actually got it done by giving money to hospitals to do it themselves, not through government programs, because government does not get anything done well, then I'd support that. We cannot allow ourselves to be held ransom and hostage by cyber bandits from Eastern Europe and Russia. The U.S. has lifted sanctions on more than a dozen former Iranian officials and energy firms, proving once again that Joe Biden is going to return to the appeasement of the Obama years. Russia, meanwhile, is preparing to supply that very same Iran with an advanced satellite system that will boost Tehran's ability to surveil military targets in the United States and in Israel. Likud in Israel has promised a peaceful transition of power. When I return to the microphone on Monday, Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year run as prime minister will be over. Naftali Bennett will be the prime minister. I hope to talk to Michael Oren about that today. French justice can be quick. The man who slapped Macron, the president of France, this week has been sentenced to 4 months in prison. He was actually sentenced to 16 months and only four will be served. Venezuela, according to the Wall Street Journal, is locked in a battle with guerrillas it once welcomed. It's what happens when you invite all the bandits from Colombia who are harassing your democratically elected stable government to make your nest in Venezuela. They've now turned on Maduro, and a civil war has battled and engulfed that country. John Bolton's biggest mistake when he was national security advisor was not to pull the trigger on military intervention in Venezuela. That country continues to suffer as Maduro continues to rob it blind. As the military addresses diversity, Republicans see a culture war target. No, Republicans see a military imperiled by what is going on at the Pentagon. Here is Senator Tom Cotton at the Senate Armed Services hearing with Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin yesterday. Cut number one.
The military has included the works of critical race theories on its reading list by authors like Abraham Henry Rogers, who now calls himself Abraham Kendi, and Robin DiAngelo. Mr. Kendi has written, quote, "The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination," end quote. Do you agree with that proposition?
I've not read that, and I don't, you know, I certainly don't agree with what you just said, but I, but, you know,
Mr. Secretary,
it's always important to have the full context of anything that's that you're being asked to evaluate.
Mr. Secretary, do you believe that race and sex should be the key factor when selecting combat leaders? rather than, say, operational excellence, technical proficiency, leadership, agility, and integrity?
I do not, Senator. I think what you just said should be key components in making any selection.
Nice campaign ad for Senator Cotton when he runs for president right there. It helps to have an infantry officer actually ask the questions of the Secretary of Defense. Boycotting Oxford tutors is being urged in Great Britain as woke politics cripples Oxford. And when we come back, Nantucket's short-term rental war, a story of privilege and power on the island nation off the coast of Massachusetts. Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, crazy places full of liberals. Stay tuned, America. That was the rundown. This is the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I've been doing this radio show since July 10 of the year 2000. For the last 12 years, though, I've woken up certain that Israel was being well led because Benjamin Netanyahu has been their prime minister. When I come back to the microphone on Monday, he will not be. What does that mean? Joining us to discuss it is Michael Oren, former ambassador from Israel to the United States, former deputy minister in one of the Netanyahu government's good friend, and to the author of the great novel, To Those Who Call in Truth. Good morning, Michael Oren. Where are you today?
I'm at my mother's house in New Jersey, the house where I grew up. She lives in the same house, and she's turning 93.
Oh, my goodness. That's probably part of the setting for To Those Who Call in Truth.
Oh, definitely. It's the neighborhood.
I'd like to see your old room, Dr. Oren. I want to see which posters are on the wall. I don't know if they're still up there, but Dr. Oren, tell us what's going to happen in Israel this weekend.
Well, to answer your question, what's going to happen on Monday, it's the end of an era, maybe. Remember, I always said in this program, it's always premature to eulogize the political career of Benjamin Netanyahu, so it ain't over till it's over. I'm sure that Netanyahu is acting under that assumption. He'll be trying to break up this coalition. But by all signs, it looks to be cohering and congealing. A couple of agreements yet to be signed by the 8 members of the coalition. They have to submit that coalition agreement by this afternoon, Israel time. They're 7 hours ahead. They'll be signing it soon. And by Sunday, they'll be swearing in. What that means for the state of Israel? Well, it means one thing. It means that a government unlike any other government we've ever seen, the most diverse, reaching across not one aisle but multiple aisles, from the far right to the far left, with many parties in between, a large number of ministers, 25 ministers, the first Arab minister in Israeli government, my buddy Sawi Frej, is going to be the minister for regional affairs, and I'm very happy about that. The largest number percentage of women in Israel's history in the government, the first prime minister to wear a kippah, a skull cap on his head, lots of firsts in this government. The question is, how long is this government going to last? And I'll bet my boots, Hugh, that the day after the government is sworn in, the Likud opposition will pose legislation designed to break up the government. For example, they can go on the left and propose a bill and table a bill about gay marriage. Well, the right-wing and Arab members of the coalition can't vote for it. They can vote a bill about demanding that Israel annex parts of the West Bank. Well, the radical left in the coalition can't vote for that. So every day, and who knows what Hamas is going to do? Hamas is going to try to break up the coalition, too. All you need is a little war, and this coalition won't be able to hold together. My guess is, and this is just a gut feeling, if it can hold together for 2 weeks, it's liable to last 6 months. And if it lasts 6 months, it'll last 4 years.
Oh, well, that's it. That's a good way to approach it. Tell me about the security cabinet. This is, as someone who does not know much about internal Israeli affairs and economics and delivery of water and that sort of stuff, but concerns itself greatly with our democratic ally in the Middle East. Who is in the security cabinet? Do you believe the security cabinet is competent and up to the challenge of Iran?
Every party has a certain number of members in the coalition in the security cabinet. Now, this is an important point for your listeners to know. Unlike the United States, where the president is the commander-in-chief, the prime minister of Israel is not the commander-in-chief. The security cabinet, specifically, and more generally the cabinet itself, is the commander-in-chief. Now, the prime minister cannot order the army into war, but the Security Council cabinet can, and then the cabinet approves the Security Cabinet. So what it's basically like a kitchen cabinet. It's a select group of ministers. Many of them have some background in the military, in security issues. For example, from the Labor Party, there'll be Omar Bar-Lev, who's the son of the famous general Chaim Bar-Lev, and Omar Bar-Lev was the commander of Israel's Delta Force, of Sayeret Matkal. And he's a full bird colonel in the military. So he's in that security cabinet. And they'll make decisions. They'll make decisions about operations against Iran. They'll make decisions about whether or not Israel goes to war.
Are you confident in their abilities?
But in the list, yes. I think there's some very fine people in that security cabinet.
Now, there is a story this morning that Russia is going to supply Iran with an advanced satellite system. There's also an amazing interview in the Times of Israel with the recently retired Mossad chief, which is actually more explicit than any Israel Mossad chief in retirement I've ever seen, that close to his retirement. Do you expect Israel to remain as aggressive in its preemptive activities as the previous government has been?
I hope so. And this is an important point to stress. There'll be a change of tone. There'll be a change of tone on the peace process, on the Palestinian issue. There'll be a change of tone on the Iran issue. It won't be as public as it was during the great confrontational days of Netanyahu and Obama. Very, very public. I think it's going to be kept much, much more under wraps. But there'll be no fundamental change in Israel's policy, certainly not to Iran. And with very few exceptions in this coalition, all members view the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, as a strategic, if not an existential threat to the state of Israel. And Israel will reserve the right to act against Iran. We will not be beholden by that agreement in any way.
Well, that interview I referenced is in the Times of Israel with the Mossad retired chief. Yeah, there were a number of things taken against Israel, which he tacitly or explicitly acknowledges. Will that kind of aggressive operation, including against the centrifuges at Natanz, including the gathering up of every nuclear secret Iran has and transporting them out of the city, I mean, that's an amazing thing. Will that sort of stuff continue?
It will certainly continue. And Yossi Cohen is an extremely competent individual. As you know, he's a very charismatic Israel. He's known as the model in Israel, meaning like fashion model. Very, very, very attractive man. How should I say this? And very well dressed. And he's kind of like an action figure. He's like something out of a Dan Silva novel.
He's Gabriel Alon, huh? Okay.
So it's something out of a Dan Silva novel. And he's Gabriel Alon. And he I think is going to run for prime minister at some point. He'll go into politics. This is you have to see that interview in that context of someone who's preparing his entry into politics. And Netanyahu has a sort of acknowledged, knighted him as his heir. He's anointed Yossi Cohen several times publicly. So that's interesting. But he's an extremely competent individual.
What happens within Likud at this point?
Well, I'm already getting text messages from various people in Likud, from Nir Barkat and Nir Katz. They're already running against Bibi. The body's not even cold yet. And, so the knives are out, and there's going to be a battle for the leadership of the Likud now.
Now, that was long rumored to be something that Netanyahu would head off by virtue of holding a snap primary. Will there be a snap primary?
Well, Bibi will try, and there'll be people like Nir Barkat who've already come out and said they don't want a snap primary. And so the battle is on. It just is. And,
that's true. It's in every democratic society in the world. Is it possible that this transition will be good for Israeli politics and it will allow clarification of the rightward shift, that this might be the last time we see a left member of the cabinet because the breaking apart and reassembling of the right will be rather expeditious?
I think, well, first of all, generally it's good for the state of Israel not to have another round of elections. And we managed to break Italy's record for the number of elections held in a two-year period, four election cycles, without a conclusive government being made. It's very good because we'll finally get a state budget. And I will tell you from personal experience, our public diplomacy during the recent round of fighting with Hamas left a lot to be desired. And one of the reasons was that the mechanism for managing public diplomacy in Israel was not funded. There was no budget. And so it couldn't function during the war. So it had an immediate deleterious strategic impact on the state of Israel, not having a budget. I felt it. But that's just one aspect of it. So they will move very, very quickly to pass that budget. And what can I say? There's no downside to that.
Well, there is a big question on the table, which is the Israeli Supreme Court is widely recognized as one of the most activists in the free world, often to the disregard of precedents that are longstanding for the entire state history of Israel, the modern reincarnation of Israel. Will this government make serious changes in the courts?
Probably not, because of the diverse nature of it, because the left-wing parties will oppose it. The Arab faction will oppose it. But the problem will remain, and that is that unlike you, Hugh, and other 300 million Americans, you have an opportunity to impact the composition of your Supreme Court. And so you vote for president, you vote for Senate. Our Supreme Court is chosen overwhelmingly by sitting Supreme Court judges. Okay, the model here would be the United States would still have the Rehnquist Court, because every judge would simply pick the person who's closest to his worldview as a successor. And so that is, public opinion has shifted. So there's a big gap, a gaping hole between public opinion and Knesset. And then the Supreme Court and people in Knesset and people in the Israeli public are saying, who elected you judges? You elected yourself. We're the sovereign. We are the democratic institution. You aren't. So they're going to pass a bill that will override the decisions of the Supreme Court. Now, that's the end of judicial review. Judicial review is one of the pillars of any democracy. So I personally have been very much against it. I've called for reforming the way we choose our judges to make it much more similar to the American system, and I've called for restricting the purview of the court, making it far less activist, so it can't stick its nose into every aspect of Israeli life.
The last question is about the man who is and the man who will be Prime Minister Netanyahu and Bennett. When does Netanyahu leave the prime minister's residence? When does Bennett enter into it? And what do you think this will do to Naftali Bennett?
Well, I think the big question is not when, but how. And this is a question that many, many Israelis are asking themselves this morning. Does Netanyahu go peacefully into that dark night of leaving Balfour? Does he put up a fight? Will police be involved? He's said things that sound very familiar to your listeners. He's talked about deep state. He's talked about stolen elections. And I don't know if he's going to go so peacefully. Nobody knows. I hope so, in which case he'll be vacating this week. I mean, he has two other major homes, one in Jerusalem, one in Caesarea. So he's not going to be homeless. They're very lovely homes. So Natalia Bennett moves in. He becomes prime minister. It's a anomalous situation because Bennett becomes prime minister with only 7 seats in Knesset, and of those seats, only 6 people are actually voting for him. So it's in terms of democracy, it's not the best in the world. He'll be rotating with Yair Lapid, who has 27 seats. And I know Naftali fairly well. You'll be surprised. His English is pretty much like mine, and he's a high-tech man who made a good exit once upon a time. He is an officer from a very elite unit. He served in that Delta Force, so he understands business. He understands security. He has been an education minister. He's been a defense minister. He's got a tremendous amount of experience. What can I say? I like the guy very much.
I look forward to getting reports after the new era dawns in Israel this weekend. Michael Oren, thank you for joining me this morning. Say hello to your mom for me and clean up that room.
Good weekend.
You too. It's good to get the update. It is really quite a change. 12 years I've been saying Prime Minister Netanyahu. It will not be that way on Monday morning. It'll be Prime Minister Bennett. It is also time for ReliefFactor.com, terrific sponsor of the show, and it's Friday. I've got to fly across the country today. That means sitting. I hate that, but ReliefFactor.com makes it a little bit easier to do. With my lukewarm coffee, wherever you are, ReliefFactor.com makes the weekend ahead better, especially if you're a weekend warrior. You're going to play some hoops, going to go swimming, going to go to the beach, going to go running. I don't know what you're going to do, even if it's just a walk around the block, because this is the weekend that you begin on June 11th. You're just starting your new program. You're going to get going on Saturday morning. Well, get going with ReliefFactor.com. It costs $19.95 to begin your effort. $19.95 to see if it works for you, and I think it will. I think you will thank me when you become a regular user of ReliefFactor.com. Joined now by the poet laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hello, Tarzana Joe.
Hello, Hugh. There are a lot of things about government that puzzle me. And today I wrote a poem about it. No matter your opinion of our strong and storied nation, there's one way we still lead the world, and that's in regulation. There's rules about the kind of fuel you put into your cars and rules about the wood that you can use to make guitars. Crimes that count as federal are countless as the stars. You can't bring kids in strollers when you tour the nation's zoo. In pet stores, you can't keep the fish where you keep monkeys, too. There's lots of ways that you can earn your government's condemnity, like selling turtle eggs or hitting golf balls in Yosemite. Rules so idiotic that I hesitate to share, like the one that sets the limits on your distance from a bear. So if you're mauled on public land, now or any time, not only are you lunch meat, but you're guilty of a crime. The only thing they won't control, here let me check my notes, are the perilous procedures for the way a nation votes. A law that deals with voting is suppression, and I quote, except that little document the Democrats just wrote. Think D.C. is broken? Well, here's one for the ages. H.R. 1 deregulates in about 500 pages. So don't pass legislation as a way to manage voting, because anything to do with votes is naturally verboten. That's A Crime a Day by Tarzana Joe. By the way, a shout out to the Twitter handle A Crime a Day, which lists a federal crime each day, and where most of those that I included in the poem are taken from.
You know, Joe, that was, there were a couple of reaches built in there, but for puzzle, I will stand down on the reaches, because a poet needs his license, right?
Indeed, and actually mine is expiring soon. I have to go down to the PMV and get it renewed.
The PMV is very, very difficult to do, but if you want a poem before the PMV acts, you've got to write Joe at TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com. I will represent you, Joe, at the PMV. TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com. Will that be posted, by the way, at TarzanaJoe.com?
Yes, it will.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, you.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Friday, joined by Indiana Senator Todd Young. Good morning, Senator. Great to have you back. How are you?
Fantastic. Good to be with you, Hugh.
Great to be with you. We had a very significant, if little noticed, legislative achievement in the Senate this week. The Endless Frontier Act, which you helmed, that you helped draft and guide through, passed by a very significant majority. Now, without its critics, we'll talk about that. But can we focus for a moment on what Democrats and Republicans came together to pass?
So, thank you, Hugh. The Endless Frontier Act is legislation I initially began drafting with the Trump administration. Effectively, what it does is it focuses on defeating the Chinese Communist Party. It's about using the challenge that they present to our way of life, to our economy, to our military from time to time, to become a better version of ourselves by investing in key technologies. We have done this historically. We can talk more about that later if you like, but essentially, Senator Schumer and I and so many other Republicans and Democrats recognized that we needed some targeted investments in areas like artificial intelligence and quantum computing and robotics and advanced manufacturing and other areas if we're going to out-compete, out-innovate, and outgrow the Chinese Communist Party. This is what we did with respect to the Soviet Union, though that was a very different sort of challenge we faced. And it's our belief collectively in the United States Senate that the country that wins the race to dominate, to lead in these key technology areas, will be the country that wins the 21st century and is able to defend its values. So through this legislation, hopefully it will make its way through the House and ultimately be signed into law by the president. But through this legislation, we'll have the opportunity to make these key investments, harness the talent of people across the heartland and on the coast, and partner with our allies to develop these cutting-edge technologies.
Now, the most important part of the act, in my view, is the National Science Foundation's vast infusion of money and the establishment of a new technology and innovation directorate. And that's because there are key areas of technology which China's ahead of us in fact, in artificial intelligence and quantum computing. And we're going to leave the Steelers fans way behind here, Senator Young. But these are complicated subjects that if we get behind, it's hard to catch up. Every time it's an exponential kind of lag when you get behind in these things. Do you think the NSF is prepared to move quickly and not to be bureaucratized with the sclerosis that usually goes into grant making so that they get the money out to the entrepreneurs to do what needs to be done in each of these areas?
I do. And this was, you know, sort of a key decision we had to make, as you often make in government, which is when you make one of these investments, government has so many agencies, too many oftentimes, where should your directorate, where should this research reside? We determined that we needed a couple of things. We needed an agency that had a real history of working with other types of entities. The National Science Foundation is outwardly facing. It works not only with our colleges and universities to conduct research, but foreign governments, states, not-for-profits, you name it. They're very flexible. The second thing, we needed a charismatic leader. And their leader, who goes by the name of Ponch, out of Arizona State University, he's new in the position, but he has a clear and distinct vision to measure success based on a number of factors, like the number of patents, the number of jobs created, so on and so forth. So that we'll have some metrics to determine whether or not our key investments are working. And then lastly, we already have a number of allies before it's even passed through the House and been signed into law from the president who are really excited about partnering with us. So that will give us additional force multipliers, if you will, to work with NSF and to make sure this implementation is effective. So, look, I mean, this thing's high profile, at least within the confines of the Capitol and the national security establishment. And it's going to require effective oversight to make sure this is implemented well, because we not only need to make sure this works for national security and economic purposes, but we need to make sure taxpayers are comfortable that we're really spending their dollars effectively.
Now, Senator, the Nixon Foundation stood up the Nixon Seminar, which is co-chaired by Mike Pompeo and Robert O'Brien. It's got Pottinger and Nadia Shadlow and Alex Gray and Lon Heach and a bunch of smart people. One of the things they worry about is the influence operation being mounted by the CCP against the universities and colleges of the United States through their army of graduate students. How is the NSF going to protect its grant making and its distribution of vast sums of money from simply turning into a patent trolling operation and an information espionage opportunity for the CCP?
So the CCP will have its array of its hordes of spies out there. There's absolutely no question. Step on any college campus in most of so many of the foreign nationals at your STEM universities. Are Chinese Americans, their parents may well be or probably are members, at least nominally, of the Chinese Communist Party. Most are not spies, let me be very clear, but they certainly have their array of spies that are there to gather our intellectual property, steal our stuff, steal our treasure trove of secrets, and that they could neuter an effort like this, if not well implemented. So one of the things that really improved throughout the process of the bill's passage is we crowded in ideas by using what people in Washington call regular order. That means simply going through the committee process, accepting amendments from Republicans and Democrats alike. We had Senator Rob Portman. I commend him for walking point, and some other senators who are deeply involved in this intellectual property protection initiative and trying to tighten down the intellectual property protection at our universities. You know, it's kind of a double-edged sword, admittedly, here, Hugh. If you want to spin off technology from universities so that you can generate venture capital investment and create 21st century jobs in states like Indiana and across the heartland, which is one of the aims, then you need to have some access to the private sector. But it really needs to be ring-fenced. You need to be very careful about who you're revealing what to. And we were quite intentional about that. Another thing I'll say we did as a prophylactic measure here is we took some of the money from the Tech Directorate. We put it into the Department of Energy labs, which have a stronger history. of protecting intellectual property. They're not quite as good, I would say, on balance at commercialization. So those are two areas as it relates to oversight and implementation that we're really going to have to focus on.
So my last question, Senator, there is tech concentration in too few places. Now, there's a new chip factory going into Arizona that's very good. Doug Ducey was telling about that. You mentioned investments in Indiana. I've got to find out what's in it for Warren, Ohio. But generally speaking, does it disperse centers of intellectual achievement and innovation away from the coast and into the heartland and into the states that don't have oceans on them so as to greatly expand opportunities for Americans to be involved in this 21st century technological revolution?
So it does. And that's what excites so many, you know, rank and file Americans, frankly, Hugh. Look, I mean, we've seen the convergence of globalization and what some people call the fourth industrial revolution, which is like automation on steroids and urbanization, all convening, you know, just over a course of decades. That's disrupted the lives and hollowed out many communities across the country. And we need everyone firing on all cylinders. We need every mind and every work ethic in the game. And part of this bill is, as you alluded to, focused on making sure we do just that. So in furtherance of that initiative, we will make sure that tech hubs are established around the country, across the heartland. 18 of them are currently proposed. And those tech hubs would, of course, be thematic. So Indiana, for example, has expertise in the area of autonomous technology. We happen to also be the most manufacturing-intensive state in the country. So advanced manufacturing is an area of expertise. So is genomics or battery storage. These are all identified areas in the legislation where we need to focus, and it's absolutely conceivable that as Indiana competes to land one of these tech hubs, that designation will then allow them to get more monies into the state for research purposes. That will attract more venture capital investment away from places like San Francisco and Boston and North Carolina, and then create more 21st century companies and jobs as a result.
I just hope it moves fast, Senator, because we are behind. Congratulations on the Endless Frontier Act, Senator Todd Young from Indiana. Keep coming back. I'll be right back, America, on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172.